It is Monday, December 2nd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Mount Sequoia Retreat and Conference Center in Fayetteville presents a Merry Little Christmas package, which includes a two-night stay, breakfast, and two tickets to the Fayetteville Jazz Collective performance Saturday night in Clapp Auditorium. Reservations, tickets, and more information available at 443-4531. On this edition of Ozarks, a united effort to protect the single largest source of drinking water in northwest Arkansas. The Beaver Watershed Alliance wants to use information, some sweat equity, and policy to protect the water around us. Plus, the Fayetteville Jazz Collective is getting ready for a big holiday concert. First, the College of Engineering at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville is $3 million more solvent after a major gift. UA alum Kevin Brown and his wife Marie gave the gift to the college to create a department head chair in chemical engineering in the Ralph E. Martin Department of Chemical Engineering. The endowed department chair comes as the chemical engineering department is searching for a new department head. College officials say the $3 million endowment will help attract and retain a proven leader for the chemical engineering department. Brown is a Little Rock native who graduated from the University of Arkansas and currently works at the third largest independent chemical company in the world. The Arkansas Chamber of Commerce says a new poll indicates a majority of Arkansans support some kind of immigration reform. The poll, conducted by Basswood Research, asked likely Arkansas voters if they would support a path to citizenship if several criteria were met. Just over two-thirds of respondents said they would support or strongly support such legislation. Randy Zook, the CEO of the Arkansas Chamber of Commerce, says the poll indicates a desire to fix what are perceived to be problems with current immigration policy.
There's 80% support for the E-Verify system, which employers use to verify current immigration status. There's 78% support for the DREAM Act or some form of the DREAM, of a DREAM Act. I don't want to get tied to a specific bill here because that's dangerous. 71% support earned pathway to citizenship. Not an easy pathway, but a rigorous pathway.
Zook says the poll also shows a majority of likely Arkansas voters support increased patrols for the country's borders and increased fines for employers who hire undocumented workers. He says members of the Arkansas Chamber have talked to members of the state's delegation in Washington about immigration reform.
There was deep and understandable concern about making sure that border security did indeed get increased. There was some conversation about the sequence of all these sorts of things. That, you know, do you have to have a perfect border before you can move forward on the others? And that was a constructive conversation. Nothing conclusive, but understandable concern on the part of the members about border security being genuine and substantial.
Nearly 90% of the respondents to the poll said it was at least somewhat important that immigration reform legislation of some type is passed in the next year. A Bentonville running store has been named one of the top 50 running shops in the country and is one of four finalists in a competition to name the top shop in the nation. Rush Running Company has made it to the final round in Competitor Magazine and Running Insight Magazine's annual ranking of the nation's top running stores. Rush Running is competing for online votes against other stores in Naperville, Illinois, Oklahoma City, and Tempe, Arizona. The top shop will be named later this week at an industry trade show in Austin. The Arkansas volleyball team is returning to the NCAA tournament. The Razorbacks were named to the 64-team field last night and will play Creighton Friday afternoon in a match in Lawrence, Kansas. If Arkansas wins that match on Friday, they would meet either Kansas or Wichita State Saturday evening. It's the 11th NCAA tournament appearance for Arkansas. Arkansas finished the regular season with a 16-13 record. And the Arkansas women's basketball team remains perfect after a pair of wins this weekend in New Mexico. After winning the New Mexico Thanksgiving tournament in Albuquerque, the Razorbacks are 8-0 this season. They'll next play Kansas in Lawrence Wednesday night. Partly cloudy tonight. Lows will be around 40 in northwest Arkansas, 44 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs around 69. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy. Lows from 38 in northwest Arkansas to 46 in the Arkansas River Valley. Good Monday. This is Ozarks at Large. First to organize was the Kings River Watershed Partnership back in 2001. That's where farmers and environmentalists worked together to improve and protect the Kings River flowing through eastern Madison and Carroll counties. 4 years later, in late 2005, the Illinois River Watershed Partnership formed in northwest Arkansas, involving 65 stakeholders from industry and cities to protect the Illinois River. Now, we have the Beaver Watershed Alliance. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
John Pennington leads the way through an old sycamore grove crawling with prickly greenbrier to the banks of Town Branch, a tributary of the West Fork of the White River of Beaver Lake. Pennington's the new executive director of Beaver Watershed Alliance, and he's picked a dreadful place to stage our interview. We slide down a muddy bank onto the mucky gravel bar. Towering in front of us stands a 12-foot high, 20-foot long, and 8-foot wide tangle of smashed timber and trash.
The stream channel used to be more or less here, where we're standing. And the woody debris blocked up the channel and forced the water another direction.
That direction through which the stormwater surged scoured as much as 30 feet of farm field around the debris pile, churning tons of sediment downstream. This wreckage is a relic of the ice storm of the century, which crushed the Ozarks in 2009, followed by the historic flood of 2011, which dumped almost 2 feet of rain within hours.
And so all of Fayetteville drains down through this area. And this is one of the remaining rural or agricultural zoned areas in the watershed.
This thrashed tributary exemplifies the worst of chronic neglect on the White River watershed. But if anyone can clean this up, John Pennington can. He specializes in stream monitoring and restoration.
And so if we can keep more of a green infrastructure development in mind, or smart growth is what it's also referred to sometimes throughout the watershed, is that we can always maintain our good biological diversity and not have to experience some of the other negative issues that come along with growth and development besides impacts to water quality.
A regionally spring-fed and rain-fed Town Branch has become a conduit for polluted urban runoff from South Fayetteville and has been listed as impaired. Still, numerous pristine streams continue to feed Beaver Lake.
Well, the Beaver Lake watershed is 1,192 square miles in size, so almost 1,200 square miles, and the watershed encompasses portions of six counties: Franklin, Crawford, Washington, Madison, Benton, and Carroll. Madison County and Washington have the largest portions of the Beaver Lake watershed within them, and it's a unique watershed that has portions that are very highly urbanized, such as where we are now. And it has very rural areas that are not inhabited at all, hardly. And so it's a very diverse watershed. And it does contain portions of the Ozark Mountains and the Springfield Plateau. And so geographically, it's different as well within its own self. And then the social changes, of course, the difference of perceptions across the watershed are very different.
Meaning awareness about water quality has grown, but to have concerns about property rights. Last January, the U.S. Department of Interior designated the White River Corridor, including Beaver Lake Watershed, as the second national blueway in the United States. The prestigious title recognized a new generation of watershed stewardship by agencies such as U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, USDA Forest Service, USGS, Game and Fish, the Nature Conservancy, and Arkansas Farm Bureau. But by early July, the designation was revoked. An ultra-conservative Arkansas activist had convinced hundreds of county officials on the watershed that the blueway was a covert scheme to steal private property. Lesson learned, deeper collaboration is critical. John Pennington.
We're really just getting started in that regard, though. We are planning a speaker series around the watershed that will be specifically for county quorum courts, local city council individuals, as well as people that just want to be involved and informed in the local community to understand more about various water quality topics. And so, you know, it takes everybody to make progress. And so you can't have a lot of people doing their own thing, trying to help out water quality, but maybe not have some of the people that can make decisions to help some of those beneficial things happen, you know, be informed as well.
Beaver Watershed Alliance, headquartered in the Jones Trucking Community Complex on Emma in Springdale, counts an outreach coordinator, Courtney Thomas, and an intern from the Episcopal Service Corporation, and a host of volunteers.
And so each day we try to reach out to individuals within the watershed with an educational message that will hopefully inspire them to do things that will be beneficial to water quality or to understand what their role in water quality protection is. We also look to put conservation programs into place directly so that we're putting best management practices in the watershed. Actually, we're encouraging other people to put those best management practices into place. It's not us doing anything, but just encouraging others and providing resources for that to happen. And then we also try to monitor the water quality so that we can understand any kind of impacts that we are having with our programming if we're being successful at reducing certain pollutants as well. And so it's a holistic watershed approach where we engage a lot of different stakeholders from all walks of life.
Beaver Watershed Alliance is not a membership organization. Rather, the nonprofit is made up of stakeholders from regional water and electric utilities, business, agriculture, education, and local government. Executive Director John Pennington grew up in Johnson County, has a master's in crop soil science and conducted watershed outreach and education as a Washington County Agriculture Extension agent for 7 years. So he's cultivated many relationships on the watershed. He hired on with Beaver Watershed Alliance this summer. The alliance first formed in 2008 as the Beaver Lake Watershed Policy Advisory Group, with support from the Northwest Arkansas Council, which links the health of Beaver Lake to quality of life and economic development. This is Alliance Board of Directors President Bob Koch.
The reason it took as long as it did was we were very interested in making sure we included all the appropriate stakeholders at all the different levels. And so the exercise to draft a set of bylaws, just the first draft, probably took 6 months. Then when we formed the interim board, turning that draft set of bylaws into a set of bylaws that we could take to the final board took a year. The idea was we had to make sure that we included all the appropriate stakeholders at the table, people from all of the counties.
An early concern by the organizing group was how to deal with regulatory change to improve the river, including controlling agricultural runoff, such as poultry litter, rich in phosphorus, fed to birds to strengthen bones. But phosphorus also feeds algae blooms that can choke and slime waterways. In recent years, farmers have, by law, been using best management practices. But phosphorus tends to persist in the environment. John Pennington.
For every ton of soil that's lost from stream bank erosion, there's a pound of phosphorus to go with it. And so the stream bank erosion is the largest source of phosphorus delivery to Beaver Lake. And so really tackling the stream bank erosion is the main approach to keep the phosphorus in place.
Pennington says that phosphorus inputs are of greater concern on the Illinois River watershed east of here, where poultry farming is more concentrated. Beaver Watershed Alliance is funded by an EPA Clean Water Act 319 grant, as well as donations from Beaver Water District and Walton Family Foundation. The City of Fayetteville, Springdale, and Washington counties are program sponsors. The group looks to sign on other cities and towns. Back in 2009, the Northwest Arkansas Council commissioned a public poll and hosted regional meetings, which led to the crafting of a Beaver Lake Watershed Protection Strategy. Bob Koch.
One of the things that jumps out at you in that survey is that half of the people feel that there's nothing they can do to positively impact the water quality in the lake. And that's definitely not true. And that's one of the tasks we as an organization have, is to try to educate people that, one, they can make a difference, and two, how to make a difference.
Action items underway include the drafting of a developers and contractors lake certification program, an education and stewardship project, as well as monitoring and adaptive management programs. Beaver Watershed Alliance's logo is a heron standing hip deep on a misty turquoise stream. herons can't thrive on polluted waterways and are an indicator species for aquatic health. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like to learn more, you can visit beaverwatershedalliance.org.
KUAF will host a Christmas-themed show at 6:30 p.m. December 4th at the Fayetteville Public Library. The public's invited to be part of this audience as the Ozarks at Large team will interview local nonprofits about the importance of giving year-round. Other guests include Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, and musical performances will include Adams Collins Trio, Jones and Leah, and Farmer and the Markets. The event will be recorded, and portions of it will be broadcast during the December 24th editions of Ozarks at Large. It's free, and it's open to the public. Guests are invited to bring non-perishable food items, which will then be donated to the Fayetteville Public Schools Outback Program. More information is available at our website, KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. In about 25 minutes, exactly one-ninth of the big band, the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, will be inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to discuss this weekend's holiday concert at Mount Sequoia. The big band will be playing some Christmas standards, but not in standard fashion.
That's the reason for doing some of the original kind of arrangements, because it'll be something that most people have never heard before, and it's kind of refreshing. Wow, that was cool. Never heard it that way. And so that's one other thing I like to do, is take songs and really have a variety of styles. And so sometimes it would be kind of a quasi-rock feel, sometimes a jazz feel.
What to expect from the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, that's ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. The work week was short for most people last week, but as Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas reminds us, there was no shortage of business news.
Walmart Stores announced that its board of directors elected 47-year-old Doug McMillan to succeed Mike Duke as president and CEO of Walmart effective February 1, 2014. McMillan was also elected to the company's board of directors effective immediately. He's run the international division of Walmart for more than 3 years, the last 18 months dealing head-on with investigations surrounding allegations of violations of the Foreign Corruption Practices Act and rolling out better internal controls against corruption in the future. During McMillan's oversight, Walmart International has grown annual sales by nearly 40% during the last 3 years. Through half of this year, annual sales have risen about 3% from the same period in the previous year. Arkansas's unemployment rate rose 0.1%, 7.5% in October. The U.S. jobless rate also climbed higher by the same percentage to 7.3%. 1 year ago, the state's jobless rate stood at 7.2%, and there are nearly 30,000 fewer workers in the employment ranks compared to a year ago, as baby boomers have exited the job market and some folks have just given up looking for work. In the complimentary monthly survey of employers, the transportation, trade, and utility sector reported the strongest job gains, with nearly 254,000 estimated workers. That is an increase of 7,600 in that workforce sector during the past 12 months. Primeline will expand its Malvern operations, investing $6.7 million and adding 50 new jobs to its current workforce of 46. The 17-year-old Malvern-based company manufactures medium and light-density fiberboard molding and millwork for nationwide distributors. The Arkansas Economic Development Commission unveiled a new website it says will better position Arkansas to strategically compete for projects requiring large acreage. The site, AdvanceArkansasSites.com, pools information from geospatial data to community profiles to photos and maps of existing buildings and properties for economic development projects. And a little review of Thanksgiving. The Arkansas Farm Bureau's 28th annual survey of the cost of a Thanksgiving meal indicates consumers paid about $2.50 less this year for their turkey, cranberries, and pumpkin pie. The unscientific poll shows that the cost of a Thanksgiving Day meal cost a family of 10 about $42.63 this year. That's down from last year's average of $45.12. Lower prices for turkeys and milk were cited as the primary factors for the decline. I'm Roby Brock. That is your Talk Business Update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by the Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. The last ice age ended about 10,000 years ago, and the planet has been in what is called an interglacial period since. Archaeologists like Michael Jokum have spent years trying to decipher what that dramatic change in climate meant for the generations of hunters and gatherers experiencing the shift. Michael Jokum, a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, was this fall's speaker in the Stigler Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas. While here, he discussed the end of the last ice age and the sometimes difficult job of trying to get information about events that took place tens of centuries ago.
They say the average is about 100,000 for a glacial period, but it really has varied, and I think they've changed over time during the course of the Pleistocene. But the interglacials average around 10,000 years, and that's what we're in right now.
And those numbers, that's what's hard for so many of us who don't study geology or meteorology or anthropology to wrap our heads around.
Yes.
10,000 years.
Yes. It's hard for me even now to even conceive what that means, how many generations of people and so forth. So, yeah, but that's the scale we have to think in.
And so 10,000 years ago, we were coming out of the end of these bearings.
Yes.
And the end of what we lay people would call the Ice Age?
That's right. Well, the Ice Age refers to two things, actually. It refers to one of those cold episodes in this 2 million-plus-year period, but it also refers to the entire period because overall it was colder on Earth than earlier. But when I mean the end of the Ice Age, I'm talking about the last ice advance, the last really cold period.
Fair to say that era represents climate change?
Oh, absolutely. It was a global warming, no doubt about it. And it seems the more evidence we have, it seems that it happened rather quickly.
Okay, and again, for the benefit of when we're talking centuries or millennia, how quickly is relatively quickly?
Certainly within a century, big changes were obvious.
That is quickly.
Yeah, it is quickly. It is quickly.
What can we know about those changes? Through
well, there are a variety of techniques. I mean, ice cores from both Greenland and Antarctica have been really vital in telling us about the history of that whole period, recording the sea surface temperature and also the air temperature indirectly. So that's been sort of the background. Then there's a lot of sort of earthbound geological studies, pollen studies, and the like that sort of supplement that.
You've done much studying in Europe and in southern Germany, right?
Yes, right. Virtually my whole career has been in southern Germany. Yeah.
Where in southern Germany? What are you finding?
Well, I'm in an area just south of the Danube and north of the Alps. It's an area that when I was a graduate student, I spent a year in Germany, in southern Germany at the University of Tübingen, and realized that along the Danube there was just so much archaeology of the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, and realized, too, that the end of the Ice Age was well represented. Mesolithic, Middle Stone Age sites were known, but not a lot of information about those sites was known. And so I figured, okay, as a foreigner wanting to work in Germany, I should find a niche where I won't be stepping on anybody's toes. And that was that Middle Stone Age, Mesolithic period there in that region. And it's perfect for looking at the end of the Ice Age because being just north of the Alps, the glaciers were there, and so when the glaciers retreated as the Earth warmed, big changes were obvious in the whole environment.
This is too broad a question, but what are you looking for when you're looking for evidence of the end of the Ice Age?
Well, first and foremost, I'm looking for sites from that period, and I say that because they're very hard to find. Germany is a very civilized, cultivated landscape. And so sites are not obvious on the surface in most cases from these early periods because all we're finding are stones and bones primarily. So what I'm looking for especially would be sites from this period that have not only stone tools, which can only tell you so much, but also organic remains, bone, antler, plant remains if possible, that would supplement the stones and say, what were people eating? How were they butchering their animals? what was the season of this site versus another site because they were mobile people and so forth.
This sounds incredibly difficult.
Well, it's been challenging. It's been great fun. But that's why I kid and say I've spent my whole career in a peat bog, because I focused on these lakes that have dried up, forming peat bogs now, because the peat preserves things so well. And that's really what drew me into this area.
How difficult is... When do you know that you have a site, if you find a peat bog?
You look and you... Well, you mainly you look for... stone tools that are clearly human manufactures. You look for animal bones, but especially associated with either stone tools or showing marks of cutting and butchering. We've dug many a hole where we find animal bones, but they look to be natural deposits of animals who happen to die in the lake or at the lake edge. Yeah.
So it sounds like there are a lot of dots and you can't connect them all.
Not very well. It's a challenge, as I say. So there, this area is just full of old lakes and bogs, and much of my career has been focused on those areas because of the potential of finding bone and other materials. And the only way to find it, well, we do two things. We look at plowed fields near those bodies of water, near the lake edges, hoping that the plow has brought up stone artifacts telling us that people were there at the right time. And then we go into the edge of these lakes or river edges and simply dig holes, looking to see if they threw their garbage into the lake. And in many cases, they did.
When you're digging a hole, what's a eureka moment when you know you've got something that could lead to information?
Well, the first eureka moment would be finding any of those bits of evidence. One stone tool that's clearly a human tool tells us, okay, somebody was here. And we will follow that down. We'll spread out from there and look for a real concentration of material. Then the next step is to do an excavation to see if it's been disturbed by wave action or other natural processes, because we want something that's intact. And I've dug many a site where there are all these tools, all these remains, but it's clear that the whole body of material has been disturbed and disrupted. So that's the downside of working at a dynamic edge of a lake.
I imagine it's a little bit humbling, though, to be studying people who lived 10,000 years ago. I mean, you realize that in the grand scheme of things, we're that quintessential blip.
Yes. Yeah, it does lend a perspective. And I often wonder how we or I could even have coped with these changes back then.
I would have been mammoth meat.
Yeah, exactly. No. It's just unimaginable in a way. And these people, I can't say they've come alive to me, because this archaeological record doesn't lend itself to seeing individuals or anything like that. But you can imagine. You can try to imagine what it must have been like for people to see the reindeer aren't coming through in such numbers anymore. And that area used to be a nice, you know, migration path. Now it's getting forested and trees growing in the way and animals are shifting around, and what do I do? And one change that seems to have been pretty positive is that fish were colonizing this area as the ice retreated, and we see that in the archaeological record that fishing gradually becomes more and more important. They're taking advantage of that and supplementing, you know, the sort of the waning larder of big game that was out there.
Is there any idea what a typical life expectancy was then? Is there any way to know that?
No. Mostly by analogy. Yeah. Just based on the few skeletal studies we have, and there aren't many, but also analogy with living hunter-gatherers, it wouldn't be unlikely that maybe 30, 35 was sort of the average lifespan.
What would be a holy grail for you in that peat bog?
Oh, I don't know. We have sites on islands in the middle of lakes, and so we think they must have had canoes or something. And there have been canoes from this period found, one or two, up in northern Europe. In a way, that would be a holy grail, mm-hmm. to just... because it's such a momentous kind of find and really transformational. But at the same time, I would not want to find it, because once you find something that big made out of wood in a peat bog, you have to worry about how you're going to conserve it. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as the bones or the wood are exposed, they start to dry out and crack and disintegrate. Just to give you an example, my German colleagues over there were digging next to where I was digging, just down the field away, and found Bronze Age canoes, dugouts. And they uncovered them, they photographed them, mapped them, and covered them up again because they didn't want to have to deal with the preservation.
Michael Jochim is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and was the featured speaker for this fall's Stigler Lecture at the University of Arkansas. He talked to me during his visit to Northwest Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for the first Monday of December 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums. In a moment on Arkansongs, how a monster inspired a song. But before that, a few notes about this week after Thanksgiving. Students of the Native American Advocacy Project at Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville will show their documentary, Those Who Went Downstream, tomorrow at noon on the NWAC campus. The film addresses the history and culture of the Quapaws, and it's the result of 2 years' work. The public's invited, and for more information, you can call 619-4270. A small donation is encouraged to help fund a Quapaw student scholarship. Tonight, the Fort Smith Board of Directors and Mayor Sandy Sanders will hold a town meeting at the Fort Smith Public Schools Service Center on Jenny Lind Road. The town hall forum will begin immediately after the conclusion of the regular Board of Directors meeting. That begins at 6. The town hall portion of the evening is designed to allow residents to ask questions of city officials or present ideas for the betterment of the city. While we certainly can't guarantee there will be any singing at the Fort Smith Board of Directors meeting, we absolutely can guarantee there will be singing Friday night at Walton Arts Center. Fresh off the success of a Grease-themed sing-along on Halloween, Walton Arts Center is presenting another chance for patrons to sing with a classic. This time it's the 1965 version of The Sound of Music. The movie will be screened with subtitles, and everybody is expected to sing along with My Favorite Things and the other tunes. Before the movie starts, Jason Sewell, the man who never sleeps, will lead the audience through a vocal warm-up. The event begins at 7 Friday night. More details at waltonartcenter.org. Tickets, $17. The Springdale Public Library will call on Missy Gibson and Company to sing holiday songs for the library's annual holiday reception Thursday from 5 until 7. The public is invited and refreshments will be served. If you have questions, call the Springdale Library's reference desk at 750-8180. You can break out your ugly Christmas sweater, and if you'd like, you can run in it. J.B. Hunt and the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad are hosting the Ugly Sweater Run Saturday at the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad Train Depot in downtown Springdale. It begins Saturday afternoon at 1. The Christmas-themed 5K will include goodie bags with holiday treats, and there will be a photo booth to commemorate your run in an ugly sweater. More information at the Facebook page for Ugly Sweater Run. Money raised will benefit several area agencies working with abused or neglected children, including the Children's Safety Center, CASA, EOA Children's House, and Hospice Children's Services. And Saturday, the Fayetteville Public Library will host a Hanukkah Storytime celebration with members of Temple Shalom. Storytime begins at 10:30 Saturday morning and includes stories, puppets, games, and food. It's open to the public. And later this month, the 12th through the 14th, to be exact, the Fayetteville High School Choir's 9th Annual Madrigal Feast will be at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Seating begins each of those three nights at 6:45. Dinner will be served each of the three nights at 7. Tickets are $30 and available by sending an email to madrigal.feast@fayar.net. Or you can call 445-1168. And though the Arkansas Razorback swimming and diving team is off until January, there's a reason to salute them. The team is now ranked 12th in the nation in the latest Endless Pools CollegeSwimming.com poll. In all, 8 teams in the SEC are in the poll, which was released late last week. Next up for the swimming Razorbacks, a conference meet against Alabama and Kentucky in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, on January 11th.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Legends concerning ape-like creatures have persisted in North America, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, with local variations. By the mid-20th century, the large, smelly, hairy, missing lynx allegedly roaming our forests were named Sasquatch or Bigfoot. In October 1967, a pair of men said they'd captured Bigfoot film footage. In Bluff Creek, California, Bigfoot mania spread, but often missed in the roundup of Bigfoot sightings as Arkansas's own entry into the legend, the Falk Monster.
It was big and hairy and it gave him a start. He let out a scream. The wife was laying there on the couch and she thought she'd had a bad dream.
There have been reports of a Sasquatch-like animal in Miller County since at least the mid-1940s. But due in part to national attention being given the creatures at the time, the May 1971 alleged sighting in Boggy Creeks struck a chord. Falk resident Bobby Ford claimed a fast, 7-foot-tall creature with red eyes attacked him. There were other witnesses, including Bobby's wife, Elizabeth. It had been seen in the area for several days, and the story broke nationwide. The tale was too juicy to resist for aspiring filmmaker Charles B. Pierce, who grew up in Hampton in Calhoun County and lived in Texarkana at the time. By the end of 1972, The Legend of Boggy Creek, his self-financed 35mm docudrama, starring mostly locals, was released to theaters.
Hey, Travis Crabtree, wait a minute for me. Let's go back in the bottom, back where the fish are biting, where all the world's inviting. Do you see what I see? On the gentle winds of morning, a million birds are singing, like the bells of heaven ringing, and nobody sees the flowers bloom but me.
When the film was just being financed, Charles Pierce commissioned a rock and roll song about the Falk Monster to generate publicity. Billy Cole, best known for writing Cummins' Prison Farm Blues, wrote it and sang vocals. Falk Monster was recorded at legendary Rim Rock Studios in Concord in Cleburne County, but doesn't appear on the Boggy Creek film or soundtrack. Bolivian-born Jamie Mendoza Nava handles the film score, which is rather lilting and tranquil, especially considering the subject matter. Two similarly tame vocal numbers written by associate producer Earl E. Smith also appear in the film.
Beneath the bright blue sky, no man's smoke blinds the eagle's eye, and things that fall or swim or fly, eat and breed and live and die.
Charles Pierce needn't have worried about publicity. The Legend of Boggy Creek film would eventually gross millions and spawn sequels, including one starring Pierce with footage shot at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. Boggy Creek 2 was lampooned on TV's Mystery Science Theater 3000 in 1999. The Legacy of Boggy Creek, another sequel without Pierce's involvement, went direct to video in 2011. Charles Pierce died in 2010. The Falk Monster, both the creature and the song, remain obscure.
Here the sulfur river flows, rising when the storm cloud blows. This is where the creature goes, safe in the world he goes. Perhaps he dimly wonders why. Once you've heard his lonely cry, you can guess the reason why.
Recorded in Concord, here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Billy Cole and the Falk Monsters with the song Falk Monster on the Monster label from 1971. It was reissued in 2011 on the Lost Souls Volume 3 compilation by Psych of the South of Jacksonville.
Here we come.
Sunday evening for dinner. A man was sitting there watching TV when a hand came through the window. It was big and hairy and it gave him a start. He let out a scream. The wife was laying there on the couch and she thought she'd had a bad dream. Door flew open, there's a gob of hair, 6 feet or more. And everybody saw all it wanted to see, so they all headed for the back door. Door wasn't open, was an awful rush. They went right on through. And the monster just was standing there scratching his head, cause he didn't know what to do. Everybody said it was a hoax, that there wasn't no monster there. They had all saw a hippie or a great big hairy bear. So they went down to Falk to see what it's all about. And right there on the ground was a three-toed track. Now there ain't no doubt. Everybody started talking, expressing their doubts and fears. When an old man stepped up out of the crowd and said, why, he's been here for years. He lives down there in the woods. He don't mean no harm. He's just a great big three-toed fella with long hairy arms. In that community and you see him right behind, go on about your business now, don't you pay him no mind, cause he outruns the cars just to pass the time away, and pretty soon he'll disappear again just to return someday.
Recorded in 1971 in Cleburne County on the Monster label, Billy Cole and the Falk Monsters with Falk Monster, reissued in 2011 on the Lost Souls Volume 3 compilation. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
Holiday music will be on the program Saturday night at Mount Sequoia. The 18-piece Fayetteville Jazz Collective will bring the seasonal cheer to their concert inside Clapp Auditorium at 7 Saturday night. Recently, two members of the collective, Ben Harris and Rick Salonen, guitarist and baritone saxophonist respectively, admitted that, well, they don't like all Christmas music.
I guess it's in the jazz realm, it's kind of like, well, whatever you get what you make of it. And so if you can take a Christmas tune and make it swing, then yeah, I would agree with it.
That's a hard thing to do. I mean, I don't like a lot of it the way that you usually hear it, but... but yeah, like Rick's saying, you know, when you can make it swing, it's just like anything else. It's all about what you do with it.
Yeah.
What will we hear from you guys on Mount Sequoia this year?
Well, we've got we're going to be performing the Duke Ellington arrangement of the Nutcracker Suite, which we did last year, which we're kind of turning into an annual thing, which is a lot of fun to play. It's a lot of work putting it together, but it's just a really incredible piece of music. We have a lot of Rick's original arrangements of Christmas tunes we're going to be playing.
Can you give us a hint?
Yeah, I did this year one of the new ones. I did a feature for Ben on guitar, Baby It's Cold Outside.
And Johnny so, Mercer.
Yeah, so he is the lead, and instead of being a male-female duet, it's kind of a duet between Ben and the band. And so that's kind of interesting. That I think that one really turned out good. Then we wrote another new feature for our lead trumpet player, Chase Cavalier. And so he's a real lead trumpet guy, so we wrote some real nice high parts for him to scream on.
When you're taking something, an established song, a Johnny Mercer penned song, and you're going to arrange it for specific instruments, I mean, this may be impossible to describe, but how do you do that? I mean, do you sit down and just look at the sheet music first?
Usually I'll kind of meditate a little bit on the song, not in any kind of Eastern sort of way, but just and I'll think, okay, what kind of hits me is what kind of style. I guess that's the first thing I would think about is what kind of style do I want to put this song in? And typically it would usually not be the style of the original piece of music. And so so that's what I'll get first. I'll be like, oh, I want to do some kind of like jazz waltz or something. And that's one of the tunes that we did. It was Carol of the Bells. Mm-hmm. And we did it in a jazz waltz kind of a feel. And then I'll sit down and harmonically try to figure out, okay, now if to fit this feel, what kind of harmonies do I have to use? And a lot of times it'll be something different. Many times it'll be different from the original harmonies. And then once you get kind of that skeleton and figure out, how am I going to start it? What am I going to do in the middle? How am I going to end it? And then it's fleshing out the rest of the details.
Are you thinking consciously, okay, I'm arranging it in a different style, but I want people to recognize at times that it is Baby It's Cold Outside?
Yes,
and you definitely don't want to stray too far? Or
exactly, yeah. Typically, I would. I don't think I've ever taken a tune and not done that. And I think for the Christmas tunes, I like to retain enough of the tune where people would say, oh, that's do you hear what I hear? You know. Sometimes it gets on the edge where I'll ask somebody who's maybe not as musical. I'll say, did you know what tune it was? They'd be like, no, I never heard it before. I say, that's Jingle Bells.
You know, but, you know, you have to.
Yeah, exactly. I went a little too far.
There's the line.
But is it safe to say you also want us in the audience to be a little surprised?
Definitely.
Certainly not bored.
No.
As you can be with something you've heard.
Yeah,
over
and over again. Yeah. And so that's the reason for doing some of the original kind of arrangements, because it'll be something that most people have never heard before, and it's kind of refreshing. Wow, that was cool. Never heard it that way. And so that's one other thing I like to do, is take songs and really have a variety of styles. And so sometimes it would be kind of a quasi-rock feel, sometimes a jazz feel.
So, Ben, you get this new arrangement mm-hmm. for guitar. When did you see it?
I saw it. Rick emailed me the part maybe a couple days before we rehearsed it for the first time. And so we've rehearsed it, I don't know, maybe two or three times now. And sounded good, a lot of fun. And, you know, I mean, the band always looks forward to Rick bringing in new music because he knows us so well. He knows how to write to our strengths and to sort of push us at the same time. And it also, you know, having somebody in the band that writes so much original music, it really gives us kind of a unique voice that, you know, because we're playing things that no other band in the country is playing.
True or false, an 18-piece ensemble is 9 times more complicated and more difficult than a duo?
I would think more than
oh,
9.
Oh, more than 9, okay. Exponential.
Yeah. And the possibilities are mm-hmm. also exponential. So,
yeah. Depending on what you do with it, it can be simple, but it mm-hmm. can be, you know, with that many different voices going on at the same time, it can get out of hand pretty quick.
You guys have been around for a while, and you've got quite a following. Were you ever concerned, because this is so different from anything else that's here, you know, the big band, the number of people? Are you surprised you've had all the success and you're still doing it? Because there are a lot of hurdles that could be in your way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're constantly jumping over those hurdles. I mean, it's a constant struggle. But, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And it's, you know, it's a real testament to the music scene in this town that we've had enough support to keep this thing going for as long as we have.
Ben Harris and Rick Salonen are two of the 18 members of the Fayetteville Jazz Collective. The big band will perform their annual Mount Sequoia Christmas Concert Saturday night at 7 in Clapp Auditorium on Mount Sequoia. For more information about the concert, you can call 443-4531. And for more information about the band, you can go online to FayettevilleJazzCollective.org. This is Ozarks at Large. KUAF this holiday season is hoping you can help us help some others out. Our Giving Tree, which is in the lobby, is benefiting the Outback Program from Fayetteville Public Schools. The Outback Program is looking for non-perishable food items and gently used donations of kids' clothes, shoes, and coats. You can just bring your donation right to us here at KUAF at 9 South School in downtown Fayetteville and place it under our tree. Or if you'd like, you can bring your non-perishable food or clothing donation to the Ozarks at Large Christmas show taping that takes place Wednesday night at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. Thanks. And from all of us at Ozarks at Large and KUAF, happy holidays. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, it's perhaps the biggest, most attended music festival in the Ozarks you never heard about.
It's very apocryphal because there's not a whole lot of documentation. There were people who were there. There were people who were there who have died. There were people who were there who maybe their memories aren't the best because a lot of substances being being consumed at that time. So there's different versions to the story.
40 years ago, it was the Ozark Mountain Folk Fair. Top names, great stories. We'll remember it on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
No one can sing elaborately woven vocal lines quite like the British vocal ensemble Stile Antico. This holiday season, the award-winning group sings a concert of luminous Christmas music from the English Renaissance at St. Paul's Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Kathy Fuller. Join me for the sound of soaring voices on A Choral Christmas with Stile Antico from NPR Music.
Tune in Friday, December 6th at 11 a.m. to KUAF Public Radio.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Walton Arts Center presents the Mark O'Connor Appalachian Christmas Friday, December 13th at 8 p.m. This family holiday show features a mixture of Christmas carols, fiddling, bluegrass, and other traditional American music. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. The Ozark Tracker Society will host its annual Winter Bird Language Workshop December 13th through December 15th. It takes place at the Ozark Plateau National Wildlife Refuge in Colquitt, Oklahoma. If you'd like more information, you can send an email to info@ozarktrackers.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Mena. Brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon. Antoinette Grajeda will join me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. A couple of things to remember as winter approaches. The Frontier Trail's Best Regional Robotics Competition takes place this weekend, December 6th and 7th, at the Fort Smith Convention Center. 32 teams from 5 different states are scheduled to compete. It's open to the public and admission is free. For more information, 788-7772. And our friends Still on the Hill have their annual Good Folk Winter Concert at the Fayetteville Underground on December 14th. That is sold out. However, they have now added a Sunday matinee December 15th that will begin at 3 o'clock. The special show will feature a host of unique handmade Ozark instruments by various makers and the songs that go with them. If you'd like more information about the just added Still on the Hill show, you can call 409-1224. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Monday.